Good morning. Hello. I'm not a teacher.
And I don't know if this might... Oh, it's on.
So I'm not sure I know how best to get this class to pay attention, except to welcome you here on behalf of the Aspen Institute. I'm Nancy Pels Paget. I run the Education and Society Program, which is a public policy program on education here at the Aspen Institute, but out of New York City. And I have the great pleasure to welcome all of you and to introduce a really remarkable panel. These are people who could have a life anywhere, and they've chosen to have a life in education. And I think the education system is lucky to have them. And I also think that education gets a particularly bad rap. And if you had more contact with the kind of talent that they represent, you would have a different view of what public education represents. And even though, Tony, I'll start on your end. The president of Amherst, a very fine college devoted to a great deal of social good, as well as creating a highly talented pool of people who have gone on to become important members of society and very strong, committed citizens. Marguerite Kondracki, Tony Marks, next to him, Marguerite Kondracki, who is an executive now with America's Promise, about which you may have heard when Colin Powell was the founder of it, in an era when it was thought there would be a greater degree of volunteerism in America if you could organize it and mobilize it better, which is what they have been doing in a great and successful fashion, partnering with all sorts of local citizen groups around the country. And Marguerite told me recently that they are now going to devote a lot of their energy to American youth and education. Barbara Bird Bennett has been a member of one of the activities of the Aspen Education Program, the Aspen Urban Superintendents Program. She has been one of the leading reform agents and change agents in American public education, most recently in Cleveland and before that in New York City. And it's sort of... you have to watch Barbara smoke. She is an incredible innovator and a great politician, and she's done a remarkable amount of change in the districts in which she has served. And as a change agent, she's also been under siege, which is something I don't think a lot of people understand well. So, Barbara. And last but certainly not least is Wendy Topp, who is, I think, responsible for mobilizing more attention on teacher quality in this country than probably anybody else that I could think of. And she's another person who could have made her way anywhere. And she chose to devote her time and energy to creating an organization that has brought more talent, more smarts, and I think more innovation into public education than anyone I can think of in recent times. So, this group doesn't need a lot of moderating, and so we're not going to formally moderate. They each have a lot they could say, and they're going to say it in a judicious way to try to get an interesting dialogue going.
Great. I think our plan here is to each share a couple or 3 minutes about what we see as some of the fundamental issues in tackling this issue of educational inequality, and then we were just going to throw it open to you all for your questions and hopefully engage in a great discussion. So I guess I'm starting off with this. Nancy just shared, just quickly, I've now been working for 17 years at this effort called Teach for America. Our mission is to enlist our country's most promising future leaders in this effort to tackle educational inequality. And we do that initially by asking them to commit 2 years to teach in our country's lowest income communities. So as of this coming fall, we'll have 4,400 Teach for America Corps members. These are people who are not going to go into teaching. They're from all different academic majors, all different career interests. They'll be teaching in 25 urban and rural communities across the country. And part of the idea is that during their 2 years, they're the kind of people who throw themselves in, go above and beyond traditional expectations, and really have an impact in the lives of their kids. At the same time, our theory here, and I think the years have shown that this does play out, is that there are a couple of long-term impacts that come from this, one being that the experience shapes their career paths. So many of them, in fact, do stay in education. 63% of our 12,000 alums are working full-time in education. And also that this experience shapes the way they view this problem in some pretty fundamental ways. And we think if we can ultimately reach the point where, you know, not just a few, but many of them end up in positions of influence in every sector, in policy and business and journalism, as well as in education and kind of related social sectors, that that can go a ways to shape our consciousness as a country and our priorities and our policies. So that's the big idea. But I thought I would share a couple of thoughts, probably, as you'll see, connected to our theory of change, but around, I guess, what I've come to believe based on, you know, seeing through our core members' eyes and through our experience working in urban and rural communities, I guess, what some of the fundamental issues are. And I guess I would just say three things, like if I had to answer a question, and necessarily this will be superficial in 3 minutes, but, you know, what is it really going to take to fix this problem? I guess I would say three things. One, is that it's going to take the same exact thing that it takes to run successful organizations in any sector. For some reason, I think this education issue has some sort of mystique around it for people, and people somehow feel that various silver bullets will solve the problem, you know, and yet when you're in it, you realize this is all about all the basics, you know, there's no magic to it, and that should be encouraging, there's nothing we don't know, but there's no way around the hard work of building strong organizations. And what that means to me is, number one, talent at every level. We need talented leadership at the top and at every level. It's not just about teacher quality. It's about principal quality. It's about the quality of the central administration. We need a talent mindset in this sector that does not exist and that does exist in any successful organization in another sector. And what those talented people will ultimately do is know that they have to do what it takes to do anything successfully anywhere else. You have to build strong cultures, build really strong systems for continuous assessment and continuous improvement, figure out how to come to the strategic breakthroughs and execute incredibly well. Things that may sound really mundane, but that I just so deeply believe and have to say that, you know, our alums would be nodding ferociously right now from their experience actually being part of this. The second thing is, we do ask our school systems in low-income communities to compensate for a lot, just for all the challenges of poverty, the fact that kids are showing up in kindergarten nowhere near where they are showing up in kindergarten in high-income communities because there isn't access to high-quality preschools in the same way, because kids do face extra challenges around lack of adequate nutrition and public, you know, health and such. And so I think all of the efforts to improve economies in low-income communities and improve the quality of social services and health services will help us. I also think that as long as today's socioeconomic disparities persist, we can do this within schools. And I've just seen too many examples to believe that that isn't the case. I mean, too many schools that are, in fact, proving that you can take kids growing up in poverty and put them on a level playing field with kids in other communities. And to that point, my last thing that I'll just throw out here, I think that we need to tackle what I believe is the prevailing ideology in our country around this issue, meaning I think there is a high level of stated commitment to improving public education. I think most no doubt people in this room believe we need to improve public education, and everyone from the president to people on both sides of the political aisle, everyone believes we must improve public education. But, you know, I think if we all were honest with ourselves and thought about any discussions that we've had with even the most civic-minded, committed people we know, at the end of the day, I think there's a belief that this is an intractable problem. That it's just really, really hard for schools to tackle all the challenges of poverty. I saw a Gallup poll a year ago that asked the public why we have low educational outcomes in low-income communities, and the public responded out of 20 options that the number one factor is lack of student motivation, the number two factor is lack of parental involvement, And the third factor in their mind is home life issues. And when I saw that, I thought, that is what, and that resonates deeply with what I think most people believe, most even diverse groups of people who I spend time with. You know, I think that represents people's viewpoint, that that's why we've got this problem. And yet we ask our core members at the end of 2 years, we actually ask them when they come in and at the end of their first year and at the end of their second year, the same question with the same 20 options, and their answers become stronger during their 2 years. So, you know, as they gain experience in these communities, working with the kids and the families, they become stronger in what I'm about to say, which is that their top three answers are teacher quality, school leadership, and expectations of kids. So the fascinating thing is that the people who are actually out there in these communities are thinking, this is not about kids and families. This is not about a problem that's intractable. This is the fact that we don't have a system that's set up to meet their needs. And so I look at that and I think, gosh, you know, there's a set of assumptions in our country right now that constitutes this prevailing ideology that undergirds everything we're doing, our priorities, our choices, our policies, and our practices. And until we can change that, I think we won't really get where we need to go ultimately.
Well, she said it all. That's exactly what I believe. I think I have been the superintendent in three urban school districts, Nancy has said, all of which have suffered all of the long list, the laundry list of everything that we could find that is absolutely wrong. Each of those school districts that I entered had low morale of the people who worked in the system, naughty behavior exhibited by people who were ordering from Victoria's Secret from their school budgets, buildings that were left in disrepair and crumbling, clearly the displacement of resources, and at the bottom of the list were people who really had given up belief in children and found it much easier to, as you ended, to blame families. And so when I went into the last school district where I was the CEO in Cleveland, one of the things at each of the platforms where I had opportunity to speak to community was to say, I do not believe in parent involvement. You know, and everybody was like, oh my gosh, we have the wrong candidate here. Because our parents were not, and our families were not able to be involved, not able to participate, and I think that we spent an incredible amount of energy and resources figuring out whether we could fry enough chicken and offer enough coffee and what time we should schedule the meetings, yada, yada, yada. So our platform was, at least my belief was, we needed to do something immediate. We needed to figure out what to do and what were the three or four priority areas that we needed to hit hard and immediate. And the first is teacher quality. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind after over 30 years, I can't believe it, after over 30 years in this business, I just graduated college, that teacher quality and the development of the human capital is absolutely the most important ingredient in education reform. The second is expectations and standardization of those expectations. You know, all children can learn, and it takes a whole village, and it's with greater clarity. What is it that we expect children to learn? During what time frame do we expect this to happen? And what are the resources and tools that we need to give to our teachers and our building leaders to facilitate that process? If we believe that children in the inner cities have the gray matter to do what we believe can be done. I learned that one of the other pieces, I think, in this education reform that has been left to the side is our inability as educators to figure out what are the important collaborations and partnerships. And one of the things that I've learned is that we can't do this alone. We simply cannot. And those partnerships have to be formed with elected officials on both sides. I really don't, and actually there was a headline once, it said, we don't know whether she's an R or a D. It doesn't seem that she matters, just who can help her and those kids. Absolutely, I really don't care. But if the agenda is one that says, here are the resources and here are the ways in which we can improve public education, then I'm on whatever side of the aisle you need me to sit on, because that's an important collaboration. The second is corporate support. And I mean corporate support in more than just the check writing. What are the other ways in which corporate communities can support school districts? And thirdly, the philanthropic community. I love the philanthropic community, but what I've learned is, I hope in my next superintendency, perhaps I don't offend anybody, but the philanthropic community seems to like to say, we are doing blank. And would you like to do blank? Well, they got a check behind that. Of course we'll do blank. Because we're always looking for the dollars and the resources to improve education. What I've learned, however, is to say, no, we're really not doing that. Here is what we're going to do, and we would hope that you would join us in terms of aligning the resources that we need. So the engagement of those three levels of community in partnership with the grassroots community, I think, is incredibly important if we're to reach the goal of teacher quality, improving facilities, technology, additional resources, et cetera. And I think that the other piece that we don't do very well in education that's very important, particularly in urban cities and in minority communities, is we don't have clarity of message. This stuff of education is so messy that people don't quite understand it. And we have not been able to find a platform that clearly articulates expectations. If I were to say to anybody here, what are the standards? What's NCLB mean? No Child Left Behind. What is AYP? What does standardized proficiency mean, et cetera? We all have a different notion of what that means, and we have not been able to clearly articulate the message, and hence we get screwed up a little bit in the media because it seems that we speak with forked tongue. And so I think that we really need to figure out what the clarity of message and purpose is. And then lastly, what I've learned is that our schools are not broken beyond repair, and that having been at one point, I don't know if I told you this, Marguerite, but I was really Buffy St. Marie. Long black hair and the guitar, I mean. Any kind of a protest, a civil rights movement, or anything that would, there I was. And what I've learned is that this whole notion of paradigm and paradigm shift happens so quickly that you don't see it happening before your eyes. And it requires that we step back from what it is that we do and are very thoughtful about the work that we're engaged in. So that I've had an opportunity in these superintendencies to sit back and say, what do we really value? Do we, do the people that we're engaged with in the partnerships, do we really value the children that we service? And I think I've had some painful confrontations with the answers to that question. And if we don't take a look at valuing the children in our classrooms, because I do believe that American democracy starts in public education's classrooms. And I believed everything that Mrs. Wilkes taught me in economics and everything that Mr. Nadelstern taught me and Mrs. Nadelstern taught me in social studies, that this is a country that is built upon the diversity of its people and the diversity of the people and the challenge of re-energizing the people to put back into the community as a good citizen. If we don't do that, I am very, very frightened that we're going to have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of children across this nation who are going to be so displaced that they are going to find, they will threaten all that we value. And so it becomes not only a profession for me, it becomes a religious fervor to figure out how, in fact, are we going to change public education. And I believe that the place that we start to change it is through our teachers and through the human capital that stands before those children each day.
Good, thanks. So I am president of America's Promise, which Colin Powell founded 10 years ago. And as Nancy said, we do try to mobilize communities and organizations across all sectors, elected officials, business, as well as the nonprofit and philanthropic communities, on behalf of kids. And we have decided that our kids are in crisis more so than ever before, and we have just launched a new 5-year plan to say that we're going to change the lives of 15 million disadvantaged kids, and our number one metric, our number one measure of success will be high school graduation. And in this country, you ought to be able to take that for granted, that every young person will graduate from high school. But we obviously cannot take that for granted. In fact, a third of our young people do not graduate from high school. Another one-third who do graduate aren't prepared for college or work. They have to have some remedial courses, sometimes even in basic literacy. And so that leaves only one-third of young people coming out of high school age who are ready for success. Well, it's only in baseball that batting 300 is considered acceptable. And I think for this country, this wealthy country, it is unconscionable that we are allowing this to continue. So America's Promise does believe in collaborations, and we are going to mobilize across this great country corporations, volunteers, communities, elected officials, all focused, laser focused on seeing that 15 million disadvantaged young people do have a chance at real success in life. And our number one measurement will be high school graduation. So one thing I want to ask is, how can this country have the best higher ed system in the world, but the most mediocre K through 12 system? And I am like Wendy and Barbara, where is the national will? Indeed, where is the national outrage? We should not tolerate this. And then the heart of it all that hurts the most is the inequality that is baked into this system. It is truly an accident of birth as to whether a young person is going to have a shot at success or not. The American Dream, you saw the survey earlier this week that was commissioned by the Aspen Institute. People no longer believe they have a real shot at it, even though they still theoretically believe in it. We did focus groups of young people. They feel the same way. When they are in grade school, they believe in the American Dream. The older they get, the less they believe it's available to them. And so that is just a tragedy, to think that the innocence of youth is so quickly lost when they believe that they don't have a shot at success. The United States probably has the worst social mobility in the Western world. Where you're born will determine how well you're going to do in life, and until we break the cycle of the inadequacy of public education, we are not going to break the cycle of poverty. I really believe what Joel Klein said at the first of the week. Only 30% of our eighth graders are proficient in science, in reading and in math, and internationally we are 27th in math and science proficiency. Just a few more statistics, but that when it comes to education, the income gap between the haves and the have-nots is unbelievably wider, and that is part of the real crisis that I think we are coming together to talk about here this morning. And I really believe that we've got to, instead of dumbing down what we're trying to do so more kids can get out of school, we really have to raise the standards. And I do happen to believe a lot of us here might not believe in much of what Bush is saying, but one good thing is he did talk about the soft bigotry of low expectations, and I think actually that resonates well. I think a college preparation curriculum should be the default curriculum, and then there should be an opting out for some circumstantial reasons. In 2010, two-thirds of the new jobs being created are going to require some kind of post-secondary training and some kind of post-secondary-based skills. Today, only 14% of jobs in America today are unskilled jobs. And so more kids have got to be prepared. Without marketable skills, they're not going to get a job where they will have benefits, where they will have any chance for advancement, where they will have any chance of supporting a family. So this business of dropouts, which I led with for my upfront statistic, is a silent epidemic. It's a national crisis, and it does seem to be falling on deaf ears. 1 million young people every year drop out of school. We talk a lot about bird flu and other threats to our national security, and terrorism certainly dominates the news. But I think this is the most insidious threat to our national security and our national stability. The failure to prepare every young person for success in the world, the failure, therefore, to prepare the workforce needed for the next generation, and, therefore, the failure to realize the full potential of every young human being. So this silent epidemic is really at the heart of America's Promise new 5-year plan. Here's a wonderful but poignant personal story. I was talking to a 17-year-old Hispanic in the L.A. area just recently, and she showed me two class photos. One was from the ninth grade, her class photo, and she pointed out over 24 of her best buddies that had come into that ninth grade class with her from her grade school, and they were all excited about high school and the future that lay before them. Then she showed me her 12th grade class photo, and of her 24 best buddies from grade school, there were only 4 who were still in class with her in the 12th grade. So what happened to those other 20 kids? They're on the streets in L.A. They are less likely to be regularly employed. They're less likely to escape poverty, even if they do find full-time work. They're less likely to get married. They're more likely to have a child out of wedlock. They're more likely to end up on drugs. They're more likely to end up in prison. All of those odds are things this nation should not tolerate, when I do believe that a simple matter of fixing public education and demanding the kind of standards and expectations young kids deserve is the simple answer. We do know what to do. These kids, those 20 kids that left Nancy's class in L.A., they are not going to be part of the workforce and the leadership that this country needs in the 21st century. They're going to have a hard enough time just surviving. Just two more statistics I want to leave with you. I feel so strongly that, as Joel Klein says, good education is a moral imperative, but it's now become an economic imperative. And I really believe we've lost a generation. So we've got to wake up and get serious about this. I mentioned the 1 million dropouts every year. They cost this nation $325 billion, these dropouts do, in lost wages and productivity. So the cost to the nation is enormous, and there are all kinds of additional statistics. There are so many direct links to lack of education and the social cost. For example, if you had 1% improvement in high school graduation rates, it would save over $1.5 billion just in the criminal justice system alone. And this has been proven with longitudinal studies. Every lost youth costs our society $2 million. There's amazing data that supports all of this. And then the cost to the business community. Again, the business community can no longer tolerate us batting 300. I know that. Then the cost to the individual. Without an adequate education, obviously it's harder and harder to break that cycle of poverty. And yet there is a return on investment in kids. And I've mentioned the social costs, but there's a positive return on investment. Dr. Jim Heckman is a Nobel laureate at the University of Chicago. He's done some amazing studies that really do focus on the economics of investing in young people. For example, Wendy mentioned the difficulties that young kids have when they come to school from disadvantaged backgrounds. If we could invest in preschool education, for every dollar, it returns $7. And so we have just commissioned Dr. Heckman to do some additional studies, and that's going to be released this fall, that has even more dramatic returns if you will sustain the investment in these disadvantaged kids. If you give them that boost that helps them succeed in the classroom, if you can sustain a certain investment in these young people versus a one-shot with preschool or an intervention at adolescence, we're going to be able to demonstrate through this the work of the Nobel laureate, Dr. Heckman, a real return, an even greater return on investment. I love what Bill Gates is trying to do. His domestic priority with the Gates and now Buffett monies do focus on education, and he believes that every child should be prepared for college, for work, and for citizenship. And David Gergen mentioned that he and I and others, including Wendy, are talking about making youth service, some volunteer kind of commitment, such as Teach for America, more a part of our national expectations of our young people. So I really do believe that we should prepare our young people better. We owe that to them, and our nation needs it. So to succeed and to stay the course, it is going to take the will of this nation and the leadership that's represented here at Aspen. Thank you.
Tony.
Wow. Well, it's an honor to be part of this discussion with you all and doing the amazing work that you're doing. I start with three principles for thinking about education. Every student should have an equal chance at the start. Students who need extra help should get extra help, not less help. And as the system moves towards its pinnacle, there should be opportunities to excel based on merit rather than on inherited privilege. The K-12 system in the United States is almost seemingly designed to have the opposite outcomes of those basic, I think, American principles. Yes, we have, you know, particular structural problems, unions that have become defensive, I think, for understandable reasons, bureaucracy that's overregulated and sometimes inefficient. Yes, those are there. But there are also deeper structural problems. There's the structural problem of unequal funding, which Laurie and her colleagues are working on through legal channels, which is if you create a system in which funding for schools is based on local property values, you are in you have created a system that that reinforces inequality big time. But perhaps even more fundamental than that, and we've talked about this over the last few days, and Joel certainly talks about it, is the sort of social belief that these are not our kids. That we have a passion as parents to make sure that our kids get what they need, but that somehow the broader population of children is not our kids and we don't engage passionately in the same way. And that is deteriorates the social fabric as well as the educational outcomes and the future prospects of this country. Quality teachers, leadership, all essential. Wendy, I think, has really broken ground in terms of making clear the difference we can make. Maybe we need to go rapidly up to scale. I'm even ready to consider a two-year mandatory national service requirement, perhaps before college, in which we would have students would have a different set of experiences, and we would get people involved in the way that Wendy gets them involved after college. I think Richard Kallenberg's work at the Century Foundation is fascinating about the use of choice so that we mix students in terms of not the sort of forced busing model, which I think actually may have set us back, but in terms of economic changes so that every school is a majority middle-class school, but students get to choose schools and students move in all directions accordingly. I think fascinating work. I don't want to leave the university and college community out of this mix, and I'm the one sort of representing that sector, I suppose. We need to partner with the K-12 system in substantive ways, and the University of Chicago is doing very impressive things on this front, and others are as well, but we need to go much more up to scale. And not only do we need to do that substantively, but if we do it substantively, that gives us the legitimacy to speak on the issue. And it's an issue which at least the high end of higher education has not spoken very eloquently or strongly about. There has been an assumption for close to a century now that the finest of universities and colleges can cream off the best students from our public education system and the rest of it be damned. And that is destructive of the society, and it's not in our self-interest in higher education because it constrains the pool of talent from which we can draw. If we don't have a K-12 system that works, the finest higher education system in the world can't do its work. And it's time for us to step up to the plate on that front. We need to have outreach efforts to find students who aren't thinking about the best colleges but are qualified for it. We need to think about our financial model that scares people off with a sticker price that is truly astonishing. There is much work to be done. And I believe if we do that work, if the finest universities and colleges in the land say, this is important to us, and we demand students from a broader sector of the society, from all of society, who are prepared to come to us, that demand will speak eloquently, will affect the supply, and will bring our influence as institutions to bear on the larger system that we have turned our backs upon. This is a particular challenge. Let me just suggest that this is not easy. Amherst, institutions like Amherst, have resources to do things that most institutions don't have. We also have an additional responsibility, it seems to me, to do those things. And we have to be careful that when we act, it is not simply in our self-interest, because there are things we can do. But one of the ways I've tried to raise the stakes in our conversation is to say, even on the outreach effort, even on the access effort, if there are things that we can do that will be in Amherst's interest and that Amherst has the resources to do, and a few other places have the resources to do, but if we do them, we will actually hurt the system as a whole because other institutions don't have our resources and will be forced to clamor into merit aid and other inefficient techniques that will actually make this problem worse, then we shouldn't do what is maybe in our self-interest and we're able to do. We need to be responsible citizens and leaders in the education system as a whole, rather than just serving our self-interest at the pinnacle of that sector.
This panel has an unusual set of credentials and expertise, and they have talked among themselves about how to moderate a dialogue here. So, Wendy, do you want to start, or?
Well, I think the idea was that we were simply going to throw it open for questions.
We can talk among ourselves.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the panels have lasted longer and given you less time for questions. Since this topic is of great interest to so many people, we thought we would open it up sooner to questions.
Great.
Great.
Okay.
They seem ready.
Well, that's right. Let's start here.
I would love to know how your plans for improving teacher quality in America.
Let me just mention that in addition to individual ideas, we do need some national policy decisions. And I think we don't have the luxury of time to wait on each school district to tumble to the obvious. And so I think that we do need some national standards or at least national benchmarks on, and No Child Left Behind is a start in terms of teacher qualifications, but it's not fully funded and they are not being rigorous enough in enforcing the teacher qualifications, and they are allowing states to opt out and dumb down and set their own standards. So we've got to have the water level raise all boats more quickly than waiting on a few vigorous social entrepreneurs. We really need a vigorous system change.
Let me dive in and be controversial. I would actually say that's not going to get us where we need to be, based on what I've seen. I mean, because I I'm not trying to put Teach for America out there again, just to clarify once again, as the model for teacher quality. It's not our mission. It's really not, we're not trying to affect systemic change in the way new teachers are brought into the profession. We're saying we need to enlist our country's most promising future leaders in realizing that this issue of educational inequality is our generation's civil rights issue, and they need to fight this battle from inside the classroom initially and ultimately from every sector in society. That being said, I mean, my personal view, because, of course, we work with lots of human resources departments all across the country, and we have learned a lot about how to select and train and support teachers so that they're effective. And, you know, back to what I was saying at the beginning, I guess, again, when you think about what any successful organization does, they are out there recruiting aggressively to get the very best people they can get who have the personal characteristics they think are important in their context. They're selecting them through rigorous standards. They are investing in their training and in their ongoing management. Now, what I just said could not be further from what most school districts in our country do. And I think there's a mindset, and I think it's perpetuated by the fact that we regulate districts to death from the federal and state levels around this issue. There's a mindset that actually teacher quality is not the district's problem. It's states and it's schools of education and it's whatever. And I actually think that we should step back as a country and realize that we've changed the context here a bit. Like 10 years ago, there was no accountability movement, at least not compared to how strong it is today. So now we have all of this, like, you know, we have a mindset, we have a policy framework that says we're going to hold school districts accountable for results. But what we haven't done is rethought in any way the fact that we're still tying their every move on all the inputs. So if you told a company, you've got to make X growth or whatever it is, but we're going to tell you exactly who you can hire and who you can't hire, and, you know, we're going to do all the training of those people somewhere else. I mean, it's totally counterintuitive. So I think that we have a real opportunity in a context of accountability to say, okay, can we give districts a little more flexibility here enact policies that encourage them to invest in the talent equation?
I think there's a basic difference between investment and creation. And so as a superintendent and wanting absolutely the freedom to determine the input so that I can get you the output, I do want the raw material to come prepared. So I don't want an individual who walks across the threshold and who may have been a great test taker and may have taken every course that was required somewhere who cannot teach. Because then I must take a huge portion of my budget and invest in in-service training. And I tell you, some of the in-service is really the pre-service that should have been done. I do think there ought to be ongoing professional retooling, and I would like to be free to determine where teacher placement is based not on seniority. I think we need to rethink tenure. I think we need to rethink how, in fact, teachers get selected and placed in particular schools, and that then there are programs designed within the district that support those teachers' ongoing work. I do think that we absolutely must rethink what teacher education programs look like. They are antiquated. They are not meeting the needs of the 21st century, and hence the respect for the profession is diminished because, it used to be with Bill Cosby, remember? Oh, you're dumb, you're a teacher. He had some album. I was really offended by it. You know, it's the punchline in some joke. Ha, 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 you're dumb, you're a teacher. Ha, 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 that's the most important person that we need to change this our country. And so I do think it starts with the preparation at the university and college and giving freedom for mobility within a district to support the ongoing efforts of those teachers.
Give you one example just to build on this for a second. And Barbara put out an initiative in Cleveland on literacy so that because there's a lot of evidence that if children can't read at their grade level by the end of the third grade, they're in serious trouble from then on, and it's harder and harder to fix the problem. And in that initiative, it was critical that the teachers in the system be able to do what is called formative assessment, which is basically identify what your students know and what they're learning day by day, week by week. There is hardly a school of education in this country that is preparing teachers with the know-how to use a tool we now believe is essential for the improvement of instruction, and that is the use of formative assessment tools. I just want to put that out there so you understand in a concrete example what they mean when they say there are things that aren't quite right in the way that teachers are prepared.
The question is whether our schools of ed
will
do that,
yes,
ever.
Right. It's just an example that I wanted to put out there.
Yeah.
Lori?
Hi, I'm Lori Tisch, and I'm chairing the Center for Educational Equity at Columbia Teachers College with Michael Liddell. So my question is, Michael and I went to Washington a couple of weeks ago to roll out the Campaign for Educational Equity. And we met with senators, congresspeople on both sides of the aisle. I knew that Washington was currently very politically charged. I was surprised at how close it was. We met with Democrats, we met with Republicans. The Republicans that we met with came right out and gave us all the facts and figures about, you know, schools in Florida that were spending half of what they're spending in New York, half of what they're spending in Detroit, and how their test scores are much higher, et cetera, et cetera. So my question is, in this political environment, is there any possibility of affecting policy like universal pre-K? I mean, to me, it seems so politically charged.
Well, you can start with some things that are easier to do. There are some low-hanging fruit. For example, in a study of dropouts recently, most dropouts drop out because they can and because they're bored and they think the curriculum is irrelevant and no one cares. And so one piece of low-hanging fruit is that the dropout, the legal school age, you assume kids are going to stay in school and are supposed to stay in school until they finish high school. But 35 states allow young people to drop out of school at age 16. And that's left over from the agriculture economy. I mean, that's a simple example of an education policy change that could cut dropouts by maybe 25%. So I do think it's a politically charged environment. It's an election year, and then there's a presidential race coming up. So it's going to be tough, and everything's expensive. Universal pre-K just lost in California.
And so everything is expensive, and there's no discretionary money, but there must be a national will for this, and there must be. I know the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is working with America's Promise to aggressively take on K through 12 education, and the abysmal dropout issue and the lack of workforce preparation. So with a large enough cacophony of businesses and interested civic leaders, we perhaps can redirect some resources and make a big difference. But it's an enormous, complicated problem, and you have to start with a few wins to show that we can make some changes and we can be, make some progress. I'm going to call on, I want to call on Mort.
Can I just say one slightly provocative thing? Of course, money by itself is not everything, but it does make a huge difference. And when you have a difference of from a 1 to 10 ratio of per student expenditure at the best funded and the worst funded district, you can't tell me that doesn't make a difference. And let me be a little obnoxious. To legislators who say it's irrelevant, ask them whether they're ready to put their kids in the school district that's at the 1 rather than the 10. Let's be honest, you know.
I'd like to ask Wendy about this resource issue. I mean, I take it that you would like more money in the school system, but that reform is necessary first. But if you could do it, how much more money would you put in, and how would you spend it? In other words, what should a quality teacher be paid?
Let me back up from the resources thing for a minute, and then get there. I mean, I'm just putting out there my real viewpoints, even though, I don't know. I actually believe, like, when I look at this overall issue and reflect on everything that's been said, like, I think that there are a few problems. One is either people don't understand the nature of the extent of the problem and the extent of the degree to which that in this country where we all aspire to be a land of opportunity, we are not a land of opportunity in this respect. Like, either they don't understand that, they don't understand that it's solvable, one of my theories. Like, I truly believe that even as we all listened to Marguerite talk about the dropouts in L.A., I wonder what was running through our mind. Because I know that those dropouts, from what I've seen, I wouldn't have known this 17 years ago, but I know that that problem didn't have to exist. And I wonder, I do still believe that deep down we believe it's intractable. If we recognize the problem, we think it's solvable. One thing that I do believe is that I personally think that there's not an understanding of the solution. I mean, I think I personally view the solution as different from what I view most people as viewing the solution is, as being. And I already said all this, but ultimately, there is just simply no way around. I mean, let me back from, okay, there, Jim Collins. People have read some of Jim Collins' books, maybe, and I think the guy walks on water in terms of, you know, good to great. Whatever. I mean, he's a best-selling business author. He just worked with a group of researchers at Arizona State University to use his matched pairs methodology, where he looks at what differentiates companies that are kind of good but not great from those that have become great over time. And he used that with schools in Arizona, looking at schools that over a period of time have either been mediocre with Latino Hispanic kids or have done really well, to look at what the differentiating factors were. And I really wish that report was taking off in the way that Good to Great was. It's called Beat the Odds. And it essentially, it basically says, you know, what I said at the beginning, which is that ultimately, it turned out that the differentiators weren't a lot of the things that we all are embracing as a country. They were actually an exceptional leader who was going to take no excuses and just deeply knew that the kids could perform, was going to do whatever it took. There was, things like constant assessment, using assessment in a formative way to really understand where kids are and individualize the approach to kids. I mean, all these basic things that any well-run organization would do. And I guess I just really believe that if we took as the basic idea here, I mean, I guess I believe that the only way to truly solve this problem is to build the capacity within our schools and systems that we have in the most successful companies in the world. I think it's not all about people, but I think any well-run company, corporate leader would say it all starts with people. So I think people is a huge thing. I think technology is a huge thing. If you think about what essentially is not happening with technology in the realm of education versus even what has happened in the last 5 years in any great company, like how they're using technology to make their work easier and all of this, I think the potential there is just incredible. And yet, so I look at all the things that need to happen to actually build this kind of capacity within our schools and systems, and then start looking at what philanthropists rally around and what different people propose as the silver bullet of the day. And I think if we took a hard look and said, will the big solutions that we're rallying around undermine the effort to build capacity within our school system, or will it actually contribute to the effort? I think we'd see some interesting things. So I guess, to me, if we don't do that before we... I mean, money, honestly, I myself, we work... I mean, even our alums who come in, literally their number one thing when they join Teach for America on the list of 20 factors, like, remember my thing about, you know, asking why do we have low educational outcomes in low-income communities? Our core members say number one when they join Teach for America is funding. Funding is way, way down on the list at the end of their 2 years. Now, that does not mean that they don't think we need to do things that will ultimately cost more money. But it means that they realize that there's a whole lot we can do with the existing resources.
Can I just follow that up, though? It would seem to me, here you get the best kids in America to go teach for 2 years. Those kids are going to go on and do something else, and presumably one of the reasons... Most of them will go on and do something else. A third stay in the education system?
63%, yeah.
Okay. So they do stay in education.
I'm not putting that out there as the fundamental solution, but yeah.
Okay, but the question is, how can you seriously attract the best kids in America to give their lives to public education when the pay and the esteem is so low? And see, it would seem to me that you ought to be able to...
Couple things on this.
Yeah, okay.
I think we have to absolutely revamp everything about the way the teaching profession works, okay? I believe that. I think we have to start with a career ladder, and I think we have to figure out how to pay people more as they, you know, progress in their careers and demonstrate that they're really, really effective. Like, I think we need to rethink teacher compensation, and that ultimately we will discover in our schools what every successful organization anywhere discovers, which is that if you want to get great talent, you got to pay for it. Like, I do believe that. And yet, I think that here's what my concern is about the funding thing. I think that we feel immobilized by it. Mm-hmm. And honestly, without more money, like, I think there's so much that we can do that will then make the argument for more money so undeniable that people will decide we got to invest more. There's no other way to do this. And, you know, I think that what leads me to believe that it's not the big barrier now is the experiences that I've seen in many major urban districts that have, you know, through this organization called the New Teacher Project, worked to apply many of the principles of Teach for America from within school systems. And they have shown over and over that thousands of people who are highly qualified want to teach in urban areas. You know, they're producing almost half of the New York City new teachers a year, and they get like 16,000 applicants for 2,000 spots. And, you know, they are documenting the fact that people want to teach, even at the current salaries. And my last thing to throw out is that the National Teacher of the Year, just from a year ago, who's a Teach for America alum, just told me, he's had an incredible year, as you can imagine, because his whole job for a year has been to go around and talk with educators. And one thing he did was, in front of every group of veteran teachers he talked to, he asked them the following question. He said, what would make the biggest difference on your decision to stay in this profession of these two possible choices? One is raise your salary. The other is knowing that next year when you come back to work in your school, your colleagues who you believe don't care about kids and are not doing a good job won't be there. And he said it was shocking to him how, you know, most people voted for option two. And I think personally, and it resonates with everything I've heard from our alums about their choices to stay or go from teaching, because many of them do stay in education, but a lot of it has to do with how the school principal the environment they create and how they manage and all.
Mort, I would just add a little bit different. I think money matters. I really think money matters and salary matters. I think that salaries, for whatever reasons, I do think that we need to redirect resources and have seamless and clear budgets and all the wonderful, wonderful things. But money matters, so that if I just graduated from college and I spend 2-3 years and I'm single, fine. I start a family and I've got 3 kids, 2 kids. In the Midwest, we have more children than 2 and 3 usually. And I've got a mortgage, et cetera, and I've been there. And I do think we need some measures of effectiveness. But money matters. I've got to be able to pay the mortgage. I shouldn't have to work a part-time job in Kaufman's in order to make ends meet when I could be engaged in some professional activity. So I think that that does matter. And the factor that I think that is critical is also the leadership of that school, the support from the administrative side that that teacher receives is critical.
My name is Ed Scott, and I'm on a local high school board, and I'm also on a university board of trustees, both of which are private schools. And I'm in a reasonably well-off county that has very high-quality public schools. And what I haven't, there are two things that I would wonder if people on the panel would comment on. First is I think most Americans inherently think of education and quality education as a fundamental civil right, that everybody has a right to a good education through the 12th grade. I mean, we all grow up with that kind of in the back of our head. If that's so, is that assumption going to be operationally possible ever under a situation where the primary funding for schools is locally determined, and the point you were making, that it's skewed all over the place because of communities? That's my first question. And second is, I've never heard the word vouchers. I mean, has that become a bit nasty word in America today?
Well, let me take the voucher. I come from a school district and a state where vouchers are prevalent. The interesting thing on the data around the voucher system in Cleveland and Milwaukee was the other most infamous, I suppose. None of the children the 4,997 children who have vouchers in the city of Cleveland, none had ever attended a Cleveland public school. And all are used for the parochial school, which is very, very interesting. Secondly, the most recent legislation now allows for high school voucher. It was a K-8 voucher system. But the voucher doesn't buy you full admissions into a parochial high school, so we'll see where that goes in terms of. But I have no problem with that. The difference is that it was supposed to be competition for the public schools. Well, they never went to a public school, so ergo the discussion around the competition. In terms of education being it's a right, it's a God-given right, and it's a civil right, and I think that that's really good as a part of language. I don't think it's a fundamental belief in this country. I believe that privilege rules. I believe that because the demographics of our public schools have changed so dramatically, I'm not sure if we all really believe that, but it's easier for us to say we do. Because
it
sounds
too easy for those who have to opt out for their
correct.
That category, yeah.
Correct.
I disagree with you. I think you're 100% wrong. I think people do believe it's a fundamental right. The problem is we're not able to realize it because we're organized in such a goofy way that the money doesn't get to the people who can't afford it in their own community.
I think people believe it theoretically, but they don't have the will to act on it. And choice
is a semantic difference.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about the issue, though.
Well,
voucher is a weighted word politically. Choice has become a more acceptable word. But I mentioned in the opening comments that we have the greatest higher ed system in the world and the most mediocre K-12, and I think the biggest variable is choice. So I think as choice has been infused in our public school system, we're beginning to see a little sea change.
But the real definition of choice is that it's a real choice.
A real choice.
And that's
they have to be quality choices, otherwise isn't a real choice.
Exactly.
Can I just say, I think that this is the question of sort of local control, funding issues. On the one hand, I do believe there's a problem there, though I hear the caveats. The thing is, if we were to address that, what we don't want to do is get rid of the sense of local control in substantive terms, because there's a great power to people feeling like they control and are invested in their local schools with their kids in it. So somehow we have to retain that link, even if we think about other ways of funneling the, you know, the way we do funding.
This gentleman has been waiting a long time, and then we'll...
First of all, I do need to say that there's so much that you've said that I actually disagree with significantly. And I won't go into all of those details. I was a teacher for 27 years. But it seems to me there's two things that haven't been discussed. One is the demographics of people who actually have kids in school versus population. It's really a minority of our population that actually has kids in school. And it certainly applies to the voting public. Secondly, right, if we look at our schools in that voting public, the majority of the people who vote really tend to be, not the majority, but the power structure tends to be white, upper class or middle class, such as that, therefore, the voting for the schools, who tend to live in the more affluent school districts and so on like that, tend to vote for the money factors. How much do we pay? And they're already coming from school, probably to recruit the best teachers and have the best structures. And so they don't say, gee, we need more money. So that demographic, and the people who don't have kids in school, for whatever reason, seems to me have lost sight of the need to put money into the schools. So the question that comes about is, as we talk and as you talk and either accept we need money or don't accept we need money, the question is, how do you overcome and return to what has been talked about here at the conference, creating the community that maybe gets back to what you wish was true, but which I believe is only true in the theoretical, not in the action sense. And we can reconstruct the whole thing. We can come up with all kinds of plans across the spectrum of what you're talking about. But unless the community is willing to fund it and put the resources there to attract the best and the brightest, it seems to me all the talk is for naught. And then what we really ought to be doing is having a national dialogue to recreate the community of education. And how can you go about having that dialogue? Part of that dialogue, I think, has got to convince people that students aren't empty containers that a structure is just going to pour them into, and that they're not all the same, and we're just going to take this knowledge and pour it in here. Because right now, the driving factors of curriculum, for instance, in our schools, come from two areas. They either come from the colleges, which drive the college curriculum, or they come from the business community that says, we want workers. Nobody is saying we want good citizenship as a top priority. Nobody is saying we want kids who come out who are well-rounded and motivated to work. And I'd ask the question this. If you ask an employer, who would you hire? A motivated, well-rounded student whose math skills may be here, whose science skills may be here, versus the A science student or the A math kid who is not motivated, who would not be at work, who's the employer going to
hire? The citizenship is critical. Did you see Howard?
That's my statement and my question.
Did you see Howard? Anybody see Howard Gardner's session on the five minds? After you get past cognitive and so forth, then you get to respect and ethics. And that is the fully integrated human being. And that is part of what we've got to create more of. That's partly what national service could do if young people were taught at an early age to give back to others. That's part of what a mentoring relationship could help with. And I do think there is more to it than just fixing the schools, fixing teacher quality, fixing curriculum. We've got to fix the kids. There are a lot of kids who have some fundamental basics that are missing. That's right.
Can I just add, I think that you hit on something that really resonated with me, having we passed a $1.2 billion bond issue because the roof at the high school collapsed. Aha, everybody could concretely get around that. And so the campaign became one that was very real. However, for an operational levy issue, the demographics were exactly as you described. And people were talking about fund it. What is it, the basic education? So what they said was essentially the foundation will, you know, $5,668 per kid provides A, B, and C. Well, if you want art, if you want to have extracurricular, if you want baseball, softball, football teams, et cetera, if you want music in your schools, that's extra. The community, based on the zip code, must pay for that. So my point is that there is not alignment and agreement around what the basic core is that should be provided at a school for taxpayers to rally around. There's also a short-sightedness in terms of the long-term value of supporting your communities and your schools, just the property value. I mean, we could not, and it takes a full campaign, essentially, to get that message over. And I think that you're absolutely correct, that it's not only the academic, but it is, as I said, the citizenship, the whole notion of living and serving in your community. And we've not done a good job of that, and I mean the collective we, not just school systems.
People have to feel the pain. They have to feel a personal stake in the problem. You know, maybe it's teen crime or a CEO who can't find trained employees. Somehow it's got to be translated into what is the impact on the individual, the family, the community, and the nation eventually if we don't address this problem.
I have to get in on this too. One thing I've seen, I mean, first of all, to your last point, I think you're no doubt preaching to the converted in this room that we need well-rounded people with strong values and strong character, and I think the best schools I've seen do foster that. Mm-hmm. And as you know, at the same time, we have a situation where when you think about ninth graders in our country, half of the ninth graders in our low-income communities will graduate, and most shockingly, of the half who do, they will have the skills of eighth graders in high-income communities. That's the problem that we're focused on, and what I've seen to change the discussion in some of the communities that we're in and to actually bring diverse groups of people together around, okay, this can be done, what do we have to do to foster this at a higher level, has actually been the fact that over the last few years there have emerged a growing number of schools that are proving that kids who face the greatest challenges of poverty in this country can excel on an absolute scale. So the fact that in Houston, Texas, I mean, we've been in Houston now for 15 years. I still remember meeting the civic leaders in Houston when we first got there and hearing person after person say, we love what you're doing. It's just too bad because this system is so broken. You know, just like there's absolutely was no hope among anyone that the public system could do anything good. Now I go to Houston and there is a very different discussion, in part, in huge part, because there are eight schools in Houston that are showing that this can be done. Now, they are actually showing that at the same amount per kid, which is, you know, doesn't mean that there isn't more money needed to make that sustainable or whatever, but they are showing that this can be done. And just to give you one example of the extent to which this is true, there's a guy named Chris Barbic who started teaching 12 years ago, teaching sixth grade, realized that his sixth graders, who he had come to believe in so much, were going into this dysfunctional middle school. He knew 8% of his sixth graders were going to graduate from college unless he did something about it. This guy was going to teach for 2 years, and that was it. The parents of his kids came to him and said, you have to do something. Like, because they had seen what excellence was in his classroom, and they saw what was happening to their kids the next year. So they helped him go to the school board in Houston and say, give this guy a building. He's going to run a middle school. He started middle school, added on a high school. About a month ago, Newsweek published its list of the 100 top high schools in America. That list does not take into account socioeconomic background of the kids, so there was no adjusting for free and reduced lunch percentages or whatever. His school was the only school on the list where 75% of the kids were getting free and reduced lunch, but more importantly, it was the only high school in Houston on the list. This is a list determined by the percentage of high schoolers who are taking college-level classes, AP tests and IB, International Baccalaureate classes. So this guy is showing, as at least eight others in that city are showing, that, I mean, talk about turning this problem on its head. You're better off, according to Newsweek, going to his high school than you are going to the high school that serves River Oaks in Houston. I mean, that is huge, and it's fundamentally changing the discussion, the school board races, and everything else in Houston, Texas. So I think we need more models of excellence, more demonstrations that this can be done. And by the way, if you go visit those schools and talk to the school leaders and ask them what the answers are, you will hear, there's no magic here. It's all about people, talent, culture, accountability. We believe in the kids. That's what they will say one after another.
The level of malevolence and the mean-spirited I think is really affecting their ability to absorb information, and it's also causing the dropout because they want to get away from the cruelty, and it's also causing some of the best teachers in the country to stop teaching because they don't want to spend their time on behavior management. So I'm wondering what you're thinking about what we can do to invest in children's behavior and support and kindness and reduce cruelty.
The mentor concept comes to mind. I mean, kids have got to believe in themselves, and that enables them to be more respectful of others. And I really believe, you're talking about how young people are born. Nobody's born cruel by nature. They learn it through modeling and environmental influences. And the only way to counteract that is with a strong mentor relationship where they can believe that somebody believes in them and that there can be a future and that there is a better way. Gates talks about the three R's for education now: rigor, relevance, and relationships. And the point is that rigor and relevance are not enough. Relationships are crucial. Great teachers are the obvious relationship, but some kids need a little more support, and that's where a great mentor can make a difference. The bullying problem is a problem. I agree.
It's also a school leader's problem. I think several of Wendy and Barbara have referred to the importance of the school leader. There's a culture in communities within schools, and there are effective leaders. If you go to an effective school, you won't see bullying because there's no tolerance for that sort of behavior. So it's part and parcel of this whole difficulty of finding enough really competent, capable, effective, building what in the business we call building leaders. But you don't just snap your fingers and become a great leader. Part of this conference, I think, has helped to expand and articulate really great definitions of what good leadership is about. You can't underestimate the challenge, but it rests a great deal on the competence and the quality of leadership at the school level.
Nancy,
and what will be tolerated.
Behind you.
Thanks.
I come from Chicago. I'll offer a statistic we just had at the front page of the Tribune a couple months ago. In the Chicago public high school system, you have a 6 out of 100 chance of graduating a four-year college. If you're an African-American male, 2.5% will graduate a four-year college. That's a 10-year longitudinal study. So we've got pretty serious failure in a large city. The question I'd like to ask the panel is a reaction, because we worked on this some in as a family philanthropy, and we have found, you know, you're talking about how we want a revolution. And our sense, after some empirical frustration, is you don't attack the center of the castle. You don't go after the fortress. You go after the edge. And we have found if you go in early at the edge and at the school level, you have some opportunity for local success. And if you do the opposite of any of those three things, you have the opportunity to work hard to get tired and nothing more. So early at the edge and at the school level, what you're talking about often is at a much grander scale, and at least in Chicago, there's no evidence that people have figured out how to make any of that work.
I think both and.
I mean, I think you're right that there are great strategies that are early at the edge and local, but I also think we need a national dialogue, national intense awareness of the crisis, and some real systemic change. But so I think it's both and. I think you've got to be doing both.
I agree that, you know, we have to take manageable pieces of this and sort of make it work. I don't think there's any doubt about that. We're all doing that in various ways. I also agree that, you know, I'd love to take the sort of national level stakeholders and lock them in a room and say, you're not coming out until you've rethought some of the basics here. But I do think, as much as, Jim, you're right about sort of how you make progress in a way that you can sort of hold, let me go so far as to say I think there's a real political will question here and that we have to face up to. Going back to the demographics issue, we have to, you know, if the grandparent community of America is saying what has become of the sort of moral and civic fabric of this country in a sort of tisk-tisk way, and then they vote to say, But and we're not going to, put what we need to make happen in a way that, that is responsible, then what's the reality? I think, we've got to grapple with this and be honest with each other about this. The fact is, and it goes back to my earlier comments, even the very, most privileged elite of this society cannot believe and should not be allowed to believe that our lives, our children's lives, will be what they want them to be if the statistics that you just cited are true for the society as a whole. It simply is not possible to imagine that we will live our lives and our children will live our lives in the way we want in some gated community as if the decay... in a skybox, as if the decay of 90% of the society was irrelevant even to the self-interest of the top 10%. We have to be clear about that.
I would also add that my experience has taught me that as you begin to impact individual schools, you can, in fact, create little pockets of excellence. But in terms of moving systemically and having it sustained, doesn't work.
Okay.
Then why the Houston example?
Okay, so let me get in on this after all.
I can only talk from the district level.
I asked Jim Collins this question recently. How do we move beyond the islands of excellence to a whole system of excellence? I just asked him, based on what you've seen then, what's the real answer? Because he was basically saying what you would believe after you walk around the Houston school, that it's all about leadership and all the basics, culture, accountability, all that stuff. And he said, honestly, based on what I've seen, I think there's no way to figure this out other than by asking the question, how do we create more leadership that can do this at a school level and ultimately at a system level? And that's personally what I believe. I think there's not enough. I mean, I don't know how many of you have actually read Good to Great and have understand his level 5 leader concept, but the basic concept is, it's a leader who cares about getting results more than about themselves, essentially. I mean, but there's a will. There's a will. Deeply that this can be done. You know it's not because you don't have the resources, because it's your problem. If you don't have the resources, go get the resources. You can do this. And there's a mindset on the part of these school leaders who are running excellent schools, and there's a mindset on the part of Joel Klein. And, we have yet to see the verdict, but I think we're beginning to see evidence, and I will be shocked if we don't see real evidence there, because there is a leader who will take no excuses. And there are very few of those people right now. We need many, many more of them. I don't think there's a shortcut to that.
On your argument in your behalf, Jim Collins talked about flywheel momentum, and that mm-hmm. does speak to Houston. There will be some flywheel momentum when you do have successes.
I just want to make one distinction between and a symptom. I think this continual reference to money is actually a symptom as opposed to a root cause. In case it's unclear, people don't trust the people that are spending the money to do the right thing with it.
Yeah. And so that's very important.
What's
deciding
that is if it's unsupportive of your ambition. It's not true. You don't have the right to say that because people don't believe it's being spent the right way. Too much is being spent on administration. Too much is being spent to people that don't care about their work. And so there's basically a Howard Beale, we're mad as hell and not going to take it anymore moment here. And I actually believe in the good, that if people genuinely believe that root causes are being addressed, there's plenty of money to do this. I think you're hiding behind a false shadow there. And I think that's wrong to keep bringing that to the front of the argument.
Well, I don't think the panel, in all fairness, has said that. I think that it's a commonly misunderstood. I think it's a great point because it is commonly thought that more money will solve the problem.
I'm all for giving more money. Only when you have
it's a great point.
That there's a new construct. And I think there's actually plenty of dough once people believe in the leaders and the business model.
And the metrics, if you show the results.
That's exactly right, Bob. I couldn't agree more. And you don't have to go any further than our nation's capital. D.C. public schools are the worst in the country and the most well-funded.
Yep. And just to build on that, and back to Tony's point, actually, I think many, many people believe, I actually think that there's a high recognition of this problem. I will go so far as to say I think a lot of people think this is a tragedy.
But I think that they're not investing because either they don't believe it's solvable or they don't understand how to solve it. Like, maybe they think intellectually, yeah, all kids can achieve, but they don't understand how to do it and where their money could make a real difference.
I got a really objective here. We were just at the Business and Technology Conference, and I'll guarantee you none of those businesses succeeded or even knew how they were going to succeed in terms of growing without putting huge amounts of money into their research and development process, into their talent. They hired talent. They gave them a problem. They didn't know where the problem was going to be solved or how it was going to be taken care of.
I think that's why I like the model of sort of locking people in a room, right, and saying, let's rethink this, right, which is, all right, the resources are there if we're confident they're going to be well spent. Teachers' unions have become defensive because of the pay issues and underfunding. So let's make a new deal. Let's say the resources will come, but that doesn't mean you can't protect dead wood any longer, right? If it's not working, we got to be able to move on, right? I mean, you have to be able to make a deal that does these simultaneously. And the fact is, no one's been really interested in sort of, you know, being the person to throw everyone in the room and lock the door.
I have a teacher who hasn't been heard from, so if I may.
There's a Teach for America statistic that students in low-income schools, by the time they start third grade, are 3 years behind their more affluent peers, which essentially is they haven't started school, basically. And in my own Teach for America experience, my students were 5 to 7 my middle school students were 5 to 7 years behind. I taught special ed. But how far are we going to be able to get without funding preschool, especially since there have been cutbacks in recent years, and we don't seem willing, at least in California, to spend the money on early childhood education?
I think preschool and early childhood education are two different things, and I think someone said it, or maybe it was dancing in my head, that if you just fund preschool, yeah, you know, the four-year-old, and you do the preschool piece, yeah, and then you don't sustain it through the early childhood.
That's the Dr. Heckman research that's
correct.
Coming out. It's got to be a sustained investment. But we do need a grand bargain. We do need a grand bargain to cut through all this and start afresh.
I think there's growing support for the pre-K programs. I mean, we're seeing it to the extent that we're starting a pre-K initiative to get more Teach for America folks to teach pre-K. But we're seeing it all over the place. And I think, I don't know the ins and outs of the California thing, but my sense was that that was more in the details of the legislation that led to a lack of support for it. So I think that we're seeing a growing support for that, and I just hope that it doesn't divert everyone's attention from the continued issues in K-12, but I think we probably need all of the above.
I'm not an expert at the pre-K thing or any of this, but one of the scary notion I have is here's an example where I think the evidence is clear that it works, and we have been reducing our investment. That cuts against the assumption that if we had the right solution, the money would follow. I mean, that's a scarier part of the dynamic. Right?
Investment all over the country. I mean, we are increasing our investment now in many, many communities
not
in pre-K.
Right.
To the federal cut. Now, we have time for a few more questions.
I would just like to comment that I think we really need to start at birth. I don't think pre-K does it. There are programs like Parents and Teachers and Healthy Families Americas that starts working with parents when babies are born, and the parent educator stays with that family from 0 to 5.
I thought we had time for every question, but
we've been sort of dominating the front
row. Nancy, there's a corporate representative there. Let's see what their perspective is.
I'm on a corporate, on the GE Foundation board, okay? And we've actually invested in, instead of spending, money in a lot of different places, we've taken big chunks of money. We're going to spend $25 million in the Louisville Public Schools and a similar amount in Cincinnati and another to try to get this whole issue of agreement, the grand bargain. We've taken the school districts, the teachers unions, the educational experts really did put them in a room and said, everybody sees that this is not working. What could you do? The other thing we've tried to do is try to bring some of what a company like GE knows about Six Sigma and about metrics, how you actually start to hold people accountable and do certain things. Now the question is that kind of an approach really a good investment? Is that, you know, what can a company that sees the problem, and we see it from both a sort of a corporate citizenship aspect as well as very practically, you can't hire people to do these kind of jobs. I mean, how should corporations think about this? They want to be part of this, and I'm not sure this is the right approach either, but it's certainly a different approach than we've had in the past.
The GE partnership in Cleveland was invaluable, and it was exactly as you described, and it was catalytic because it was very focused at one of our high schools, a huge high schools, brought the union, did just as you said, but it was catalytic for the other high schools. And it provided the momentum, actually, for us to start the conversations with the Gates Foundation and some of the other foundations. So I do think that it's a good approach. One of the other things was that GE was seen by the school district, by the community, by the unions, by a lot of, you know, you do the whole laundry list, as having not a real, you know, you don't have a real rat in this race. There to be supportive. It wasn't that you were on either side. And that was, as I said, catalytic and beneficial. And GE has been one of the partners, at least, that got it, that didn't impose, but got it. And
the second thing businesses can do, in addition to catalytic investments, is make noise and speak, you know, in the public halls of elected officials at the local, state, and national level to say, okay, we're here, we're doing our part, but we can't fix this by ourselves. The public investment in this thing needs to be revisited, and it's almost like a zero-based budgeting model. It would be wonderful if you could take the billions that are allocated and take a zero-based budgeting approach to designing what could work.
On this, I mean, I just heard about what GE is doing in Louisville from Bob Corcoran, who explained the ins and outs of it to me. And to me, the most exciting part of it is the piece around applying the organizational know-how that GE has to the central administration. I mean, I think that of everything, well, personally, my theory is that's going to have, if that can really be done in a serious way, that would have just an extraordinary impact. The other thing to throw out there, though, for me, all of my convictions around this have basically come from doing two things. From looking at, first of all, with teachers, what actually differentiates those teachers who are getting incredible results with kids in our communities versus those who are working incredibly hard and getting what would be perceived as good results, like they're doing a good job as a teacher, but they're not getting, so meaning like the teachers who come in at the fourth grade level have the kids at the first grade level and end of the year with all of them passing the fourth grade test and ready to enter fifth grade on grade level. What have those people figured out? And then looking at the schools that are doing that now on a whole school level and seeing the difference between what those schools are doing and what the kind of average, hardworking, you know, school is doing two blocks away. Seeing those two things for one morning against each other, I have watched, not only has, I mean, that's where every conviction I've ever gained has come from, but I have watched serious political leaders with deep convictions themselves change their minds about everything they thought about education from that experience. And, you know, we have models of excellence. We need to go look at them. And I think it's not very hard to actually see the differentiators once you do that. So I just think we need all of our foundation folks and everyone else and everyone in this room to go see that, because I really think it's illuminating to learn from the people who are actually succeeding out there.
Our time is up, I'm afraid.
And I know there are more questions. The panelists will be here at the festival, and I encourage you to speak to them together.